Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at openhousecommunity.com.au.
Our next guest writes, "We spend an awful lot of time in malls taking care of ourselves and our immediate needs, and these people never enter our consciousness. Why does it take a typhoon or an earthquake to wake people up to the truth that far more people die every day of poverty than natural disaster?" These are the thoughts of Thomas A. Nazario. More on Thomas in a moment. Today, more than a billion people around the world subsist on a dollar a day or less. Almost half of the world, over 3 billion people, live on less than $2.50 a day. And 80% of humanity live on less than $10 a day. Let's narrow down the immensity of global poverty through a single camera lens and turn to Thomas Nazario. He's the founder and president of the Forgotten International, a not-for-profit organization breaking the poverty trap around the world. He's an attorney, a child advocate, a law professor at the University of San Francisco's School of Law, and generally a pretty busy guy. Thomas invited Pulitzer Prize-winning photographer Renee C. Beyer to work with him on a work to dissolve our preconceived understanding of what poverty actually looks like. The book is called Living on a Dollar a Day, and when we connected with Thomas and Renee on Open House, we started with what keeps poverty alleviation at the heart of Thomas's life.
Well, there was a little bit of that kind of approach or attitude in my veins long ago when I first noticed poverty in the slums of New York City where I grew up. But it also came about later when I began to travel for the United Nations and NGOs around the world and just discovered that so many people around the world have so little, live on streets and essentially have been forgotten by either their communities or the society that they live in or their families, and they absolutely have nothing. And it was just multiple ways in which I was disturbed, and I felt like I needed to try to do something.
You could well have signed up to any number of different groups who are in this space. What led you to start an organization in Forgotten International then?
Well, I had done work with the Dalai Lama for about 15 years, and I've had several conversations with him about the notion of compassion and what compassionate people should be doing. And it just came to me that I wasn't doing enough. I had to kind of just create. It was essentially my own project, focused a little bit around some of my ideas and notions in life as to what works and what doesn't work in terms of alleviating poverty. And with his encouragement, we started the nonprofit and raised a little money, and now we seem to be doing at least a little good around the world.
Renee, you'd had a long-standing relationship with the underprivileged and those living in poverty prior to Thomas and his team contacting you. How did you feel, though, when he did?
Well, you know, I've been committed to covering issues of extreme poverty domestically for over 30 years, and internationally since my first assignment in Mali, West Africa, in 2003, when I was working on a project, and I photographed a little two-year-old boy with a few grains of rice in his hand. He had been working alongside his mother to make coal. And at that moment, while I was photographing him back in his encampment, the village chief proclaimed, "Those that don't work, don't eat." And those words and that child's eyes still haunt me to this day. And since then, I've been moved to continue that much-needed awareness of children's and women's rights issues as it relates to extreme poverty. So I was—I really wanted to work on this project when Tom approached me, and he was looking for a photojournalist ever since I had that encounter in 2003.
Thomas, given those mind-boggling figures of global poverty, how did you narrow down the countries and then the families to form the heart of Living on a Dollar a Day?
Well, there are various factors that we used, of course. So one was just their locale and whether or not we could knock off several countries in one particular area of the world. But we did travel to four different continents, and we were looking for diversity. We wanted to not only find different ethnic groups, but also find and do stories on different issues that the poor face around the world, the different kinds of jobs they have, the different kinds of climates they live in, the different ways in which they simply try to get through life. And, of course, we wanted to spend a considerable amount of time with women and children, since a very large majority of those who live on less than a dollar a day around the world are in fact, women and children. So those are some of the factors that we were looking at when we decided where to go and what kind of stories to capture.
Poverty is such a utility word. Were there distinct expressions of poverty in each country that you visited?
Well, I think I could take a shot at that. There are some economists that try to define a term called moderate poverty, which is actually people who live somewhere between the income brackets of about $2 to $5 a day. They often live in difficult conditions, but they often have at least access to some relatively clean water, some access to schools and education. In many cases, they may live in a little 5 by 10 room, foot room, but nevertheless, they often have electricity, may even have a little bit of a refrigerator, and even a TV in some cases. But we were really looking at what we call extreme poverty, and those people live on less than a dollar a day, and they often have almost nothing at all. Some of them live under plastic tents, and they live really on the edge of life and death. In many cases, if something goes wrong with regards to a breadwinner or conflict breaks out or there's a famine or a flood in the area, many of them die. And those are the kinds of folks that we wanted to focus in on. And that's over a billion people. So that's a lot of people.
Thomas, are there particular faces or stories that really are the byword for poverty for you as a result of this project?
Well, you know, one of the things that I think Renee and I came away with is very quickly understanding that most of the people we visited had the same kinds of hopes and dreams as we do. Most of them, if not all of them, are far more the same than different. And my feeling was that, you know, once you got to know them, as that video pointed out, they essentially become your family. And in fact, in many ways, they are part of the human family. They're our brothers and sisters. The book, of course, comes with a foreword by the Dalai Lama. And the book is largely about compassion and caring. And so many of us have the ability and really wherewithal to actually help other people, but sometimes we don't take the time to do it. And this book encourages people to do just that.
Renee, many of the kids that you've captured on film won't have had anybody pay the kind of attention to them that you did with your camera. How did you create a space where they were relaxed enough to share their life with you?
Yes, we work very carefully with social workers and spending, time really is the essence of compelling photojournalism. These aren't snapshots. These aren't just a picture you take in a minute and then you move on. This is spending a considerable amount of time with each subject that's been photographed. So, I try to play with the children a little bit. I let them look in the back of my camera to make them feel comfortable. Those kinds of things, slap them five if they know what slapping five is, just little things that will help, get them comfortable with me and the camera. And also, like I said, working with a team that helps translate, if they're not able to speak English.
One of the things that Renee and I watched her do this is, she will sit or stand or find a corner somewhere and stay there for hours and kind of blend into the background. And so before too long, people forget that she's there, and so she begins to just be anonymous and capture, the daily routine of a lot of folks that live in this kind of poverty without actually being noticed.
Renee, many of your photos were painfully beautiful. In fact, I found myself superimposing the faces of my own children over those that you've captured through your camera. When you press the button, do you know that you've grabbed a perfect moment, or is it later in the process?
A little bit of both, actually. A little bit of both, because you're so, the number one thing for me is respect for my subjects and taking that really needed time to immerse myself into their lives. And so I'm really consumed with, the sensitivity of the situation and when I'm making these images. And then sometimes when I do come back and I'm editing the film or the digital slide, as you might call it now, then I'm really seeing what I really captured. It's a tough one to call, but both cases, I think I realize that, what I've captured. And it's all about making this connection with with the viewer and having them be able to see these pictures or be able to jump into these pictures as if it was their reality. So I'm always thinking about, wow, what I'm seeing, what I'm smelling, what I'm breathing or not being able to breathe, and how do I translate that into an image?
That's an enormous amount of pressure to bear. Actually, on that theme, Thomas, how did you deal with that wrenching pain of departure after connecting so significantly with people living in desperate poverty, heading back to a life that was so foreign to theirs?
Well, I'll let Renee handle most of the answers to that question, but I know that, you know, I've experienced that feeling a lot throughout my travels in life, and I've always wanted to come back and do something for a family or a child I met. And we did do some of that on this trip, but I think Renee will tell you that we often left a kind of small gift with many of the families and women that we spent some time with. But it was really about telling their stories and knowing that in telling their stories, we would help many thousands, if not millions, of poor people around the world. And so that gave us a lot of fuel to continue the work and go on.
Yeah, it's all about awareness and bringing that awareness. And so, you know, it's very easy. Of course, it is heartbreaking work, absolutely heartbreaking to be there and to make these images. But you have to take a sort of a bigger vision and hope that you're able to portray all of these situations in a way that, you know, people can make that connection and can have a shared humanity, and that will give and motivate them to change and help. So, I mean, that's always going on in the back of my head, so I try not to be overwhelmed by the emotion of the situation in a much bigger view of hoping that the images can get to that forum to motivate change. There was Fatty. She was 8 years old. She was this little girl. She was working in e-waste, where a lot of our electronic computers and TVs and wares from the United States and the Western world and Europe are dumped in this horrible prison of poison, I guess we could call it, where these children were breathing in this horrible toxic air, and they had no, nothing to cover their hands and no shoes on their feet, working with flip-flops. And this little girl had tears streaming down her face from the effects of malaria as she balanced this little bucket on her head of metals that she was trying to scavenge and find so that she could literally make a dollar so that she could eat to survive to tomorrow. And, that was really heartbreaking. And, at one point, I spent several days following her. And at one point, I said to the interpreter, "Why is she looking so sad?" And the interpreter said to me, "Because she wants you to take her home with you."
Dear.
So, yeah, this is, it's very sad work, but it's really important.
Thomas, after taking in Renee's pictures and reading your text around them, I get variously senses of depression and loneliness. There's sickness and loss and health, and there's happiness and joy in some of them. Did you find any universal emotions, though, that pervaded all of the stories of deprivation in your book?
Well, I think the common theme that we heard, and maybe there were two, but one was that most of these impoverished individuals felt that life was not going to get much better for them, but they dearly wanted life to be better for their children. They did have hopes and dreams for their kids. It was very important if they could try to keep their kids in school. And that's, we heard that repeatedly from particularly mothers who work so hard to try to keep their kids fed or even in school in some cases. And the other thing we would hear a lot of is, simply a desire on their part to actually experience something in the way of joy. Sometimes, even I thought there was a lot of sadness among them. But the truth of the matter is that they would find some joy in the very little things in life. And we would find them laughing or smiling on occasion. And on occasions when we would probably never laugh or smile ourselves, but they would take some joy in it. And even though they were impoverished, many of them were relatively happy.
You know, there was a little blind girl. I stopped the whole crew in India to photograph. this little girl, and she was in a wheelchair, and she was begging to help us, you know, provide for her brother and her mother, who was unable to work, and spending several days and just watching her and the family, you know, live on very little. I mean, they slept on a prayer mat near a mosque where they felt safe, and the mother was fanning them in 100-degree, you know, temperatures at like 10 o'clock at night. But, you know, I found myself in this situation where this little girl was clapping and singing a Mia song and actually bringing me joy despite, you know, her vast deprivation. And to me, it's amazing how the human spirit transcends that deprivation, especially among children.
We pretty much saw that throughout the world. Children could pick up sticks or even rocks or little balls that they might find and play. In Thailand, we found some girls that went into the jungle and got a vine and played jump rope on a vine. Some children would simply sing and laugh and just have a lot of joy just out of singing when they had no toys at all.
Thomas and Renee, I know that you witnessed incredible ostentatious wealth living right next door to breathtaking poverty and deprivation. How did that impact you?
Well, I've always been quite shocked at the disparities that exist in the world, even more so, you know, in developing countries where places like India, where we now have, 45, 50 billionaires in that country. And at the same time, India has the most impoverished people in the world. About almost a third of all of the world's impoverished live in India alone. So that's very troubling. It's also troubling that the richest individual in India recently built himself a billion-dollar home. It's 27 stories high. It's got a garage for 160 cars.
Oh, goodness.
And at the same time, there are individuals living not too far away from him that live, of course, on the streets. There's one gentleman who's a cobbler, lives on the street not too far away from him, and hopes that someone will walk by and ask their shoes to be shined or cleaned or fixed. And you know, I've asked him, well, what happens if nobody comes along on a given day? And he says, well, I'll just go to sleep and wait for a better day tomorrow. And he says, well, I've also asked him, well, what happens if the same thing happens tomorrow and you don't get any money whatsoever? What do you do? And he says, well, I go across the street and eat the leaves off that tree. So here we have someone living in a billion-dollar home and someone eating, you know, leaves off a tree just relatively close to each other. You know, to me, it smacks of an immorality that exists around the world and in some countries more so than in others, but it's pretty bad.
Thomas, is the reason for poverty that the rich are holding on to their money, or is that an oversimplification?
Well, I think it is. I mean, I think there are multiple reasons for poverty, probably 15 or 20, and some of them are historical. But we pretty much know now how to fix poverty, or at least make a big dent in it. And the truth is that we have been doing just that in the last 30, 35 years now. There's been a lot of improvement around the world with regard to the number of people that live in extreme poverty. Not only that, but more kids are now in school, more kids are getting some access to medical care, more children are surviving past the age of five. So we just have to continue to do what we're doing and not forget them. But there is no simple one reason for poverty, nor is there a simple way to lift people out of poverty. There are multiple strategies that are used, but they are working, and we are learning more and more.
Renee, what did you learn from your subjects that has marked your life from here on in?
Well, I have to say that throughout every country, and we traveled to 10 countries and 4 continents to report on extreme poverty, that this cycle of extreme poverty is absolutely impossible to break without help. And so, you know, the hope for this book, now that it is published, is to get it in the hands of the United Nations Millennium Development Goals when the team gets to the table for review, and so that it will have an impact because, you know, that we have made great strides, as Thomas said, but to seriously wait another 15 to 20 years to when we've got 19,000 children dying a day under the age of five of preventable causes, that's too many. One is too many. And so You know, I'm hoping that through this book and from what I found, you know, in my travels, that this will be a call to action to speed up this and to try to really eradicate extreme poverty, because people need us. I mean, if you were born, I mean, all of these people are very hardworking, and they're all got there by no fault of their own, just because they were simply born in a different place, some of them. So, I mean, if you were in that situation, wouldn't you want somebody to help you, is the way I look at it? You know, I'm asking people to put themselves into these situations, to imagine themselves. Could they survive with no home, with not even a mattress, breathing this black soot of toxic waste, you know, drinking contaminated water, walking miles, days, just to find water or food, you know, facing starvation? I mean, there's just so many things. And you just, you know, you just ask people, can they just stand in front of these, one of these photographs, imagine themselves in this situation, and how could they not help in some way?
Renee, was there ever a fear when you were taking your photos that they were going to be too powerful, too confronting for us to engage with?
That was the challenge. The entire project was to make photographs that would not overwhelm people so that they would look away, and to make pictures so that they could imagine themselves in these situations and they could make some kind of an emotional connection to the images, as if this were their child or their mother or their sister.
We wanted to actually create a book that would kind of bring home that message that you don't have to be a billionaire or a millionaire to make a difference in someone's life, that all you need to do is get involved, either volunteer or send some money or travel to some of these countries and decide to help a school or a village or an orphanage and, you know, do something meaningful with your life. I'm not suggesting that a lot of people don't do something meaningful with their lives, but it's something that I think we all have a responsibility to do. And the truth of the matter is that it doesn't take an awful lot of time or an awful lot of money to help individuals, particularly individuals in other countries where everything is so relatively inexpensive. For example, one of our projects is a school in India where we build a whole classroom for kindergarten kids, mostly girls, and paid the salaries of six teachers at that school, all that for about $800. So it's just amazing what you could do with a little money, and you shouldn't be overwhelmed by the problem of global poverty. You should be satisfied with just taking a baby bite out of it and doing your share.
Thomas and Renee, thank you so much for your gift, and I'm hoping that others will engage with it the same way that I have, and many others around the world are right now. Congratulations on living on a dollar a day.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
We hope you enjoyed this Open House podcast. To hear more from Open House, visit openhousecommunity.com.au.